You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
My name is Sophie Thomas. I'm co-director of the design department here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here for today's lunchtime talk. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce today's special guest speaker. Charles Ledbetter is a leading authority on innovation and creativity and an advisor to governments, cities, organisations throughout the world. He has a long distinguished track record of involvement in social innovation and is the author of best-selling books such as We Think, Mass Innovation, Not Mass Production, as well as many influential reports such as The Rise of the Social Entrepreneur. He joins us today to share some of his thinking from his new book, The Frugal Innovator. And in the book, Charles looks at a wave of innovations and innovators from Latin America, Asia and Africa who are responding to tight constraints of capital and resource by devising low-cost solutions to pressing social challenges, which are lean, simple, clean and social. Now, frugal innovation is a concept which chimes absolutely with the principles driving much of the RSA's current work in the design department and looking at design and manufacture. Our flagship programme, The Great Recovery, addresses some of the major economic problems and environmental challenges caused by the dominance of this linear take-make-waste model of design, manufacture and consumption, which we're currently stuck in. We argue that there's a need to shift towards a more circular system where we get the materials back into the system, and through this is a widespread application of good design thinking based on very local disruption and some of the same principles of simplicity and resourcefulness that Charles has been so powerfully advocating in his books. So it is with really great pleasure to welcome you to the stage today, Charles, and to learn more about the ideas in your new book. So without any further ado, I'm going to pass you over to Charles. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Sophie, for that introduction written by my mother. And it's very good to see all of you here. I'll just say a little bit about the ideas in this book. As I was saying to Sophie, one of the weird things about writing books is it all takes way too long. And then you've written the book, and roughly speaking, I would say about 6 weeks after it's published, you realise what the book was really about and what you should have written. So I'm not really going to talk about the book. I'm going to talk about what should be in the book or what is in the book but's not clear enough. And just to say this, I'm not the first person as ever to write about these things. Many of the ideas that I'm talking about and some of the issues covered by C.K. Prahalad in his groundbreaking book, Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and by a group of Cambridge academics in a great book called Jugaad Innovation, which is about India. And so it builds on lots of ideas from lots of people, and it's an attempt to bring them together into, I suppose, a different story of innovation. So innovation, if I ask you, I'm just going to ask you, you don't have to say anything, just I'm going to say the word innovation, and you think of a company or a product. So, this is more like a cathedral than a shop. It's a sort of place where we go to see sort of artifacts with special qualities that will sort of transport us into heaven. And it's all gleaming glass and kind of light and possibility and all the rest of it. And here is a kind of miracle worker. Because when he unveiled these things, which we all have in abundance, it took your breath away that you could just swipe like that and things would appear. And I suppose Apple, Google, Silicon Valley in general, that whole story has been the dominant story of innovation, I would say, since probably the late 80s, mid-90s, certainly. And it's one that people all over the world are trying to copy with silicon this and silicon that. And it's a story which is a bit like this, which is that innovation is essentially about competition. It's about competitive advantage. It's about using new technologies and the freedom to have new ideas. So you put people in environments where they're free from bureaucratic constraints and free from convention, and you give them beanbags and endless supplies of caffeine, And then with the right kind of facilitation, they brainstorm amazing ideas which open up new markets which people haven't thought about before, and you get blue ocean strategies and full of possibility and all the rest of it. And this is the kind of dominant story. We want more of that. And so you hear politicians and others say we need European Googles and why haven't we got a Facebook and so on and so forth, and that's why everyone is so excited by Silicon Roundabout and Tech City and Shoreditch and so on and so forth. All of that, I think, is amazing, fantastic and brilliant, but it's only one story. And there might be a different story. And the different story and why it might be relevant comes from a set of other factors that we should bear in mind. And these are, I think, global in their application, although what they mean is different in different places. And the first is that we live in a world of tightening, if not severe, constraints. So just anecdotally, I mean, I can't think of an organisation that I go to advise them or talk to, say, oh, we've just got so much stuff, you know, so much money, resource, we don't know what to do with it. Actually, all of them say we've got to do more with less. We face tightening constraints on resources, particularly perhaps water, but also forms of energy, precious materials and others, actually getting the resources for the take, make and waste system that Sophie was talking about is becoming harder and harder. We're having to press further and further on those limits. And at a more prosaic level, if you look at the kind of people who are becoming consumers around the world, they're in the developed world here. Most people on middle incomes are not going to see their incomes rise very much. The driving force of innovation in the post-war era in this economy, which was the aspirational middle class, are not going to be the beneficiaries of huge increases in real incomes. On the contrary, their incomes are going to be constrained. In the developing world, it's people earning $5 to $10 a day and perhaps eking out small bits that they can invest in precious goods and services that really count to them. So I think one of the big factors in the world is constraint, which means that people who can innovate in the face of constraint become really, really important. The second thing is rising aspirations. So what's the biggest kind of single trend worldwide, the most potent force of social and economic change? It is that roughly 70 million people a year are moving to cities. So we're building the equivalent of 6 mega cities a year the world over. What's pulling people to cities? It's the possibility of better jobs, better houses, better education, better outcomes. And so all over the world, people's aspirations are rising. The developing world, it might be aspirations to own a mobile phone, own a television, own a moped, maybe have a spare room at the back of your house, maybe have a flushing toilet, so on and so forth. In this world, it might be to have better quality, better standard of living, better balance of living in some kind of way. But there's no sense in which aspirations are dimming. So we face a world of, I think, tightening constraints and rising aspirations. And this is a world of kind of dissonance and conflict. How do you reconcile those two? Well, the third factor going in our favour is that we have apparently blessed with technology now limitless opportunities for collaboration. And those opportunities to collaborate in new ways, to create new models of organisation, to share resources and to create things together in more imaginative ways is the greatest abundant resource that we have. And so the task of innovators, I think, is going to be about how you meet severe constraints to meet rising aspirations using these opportunities for collaboration. What's the rub of that? The rub is you can't do that without challenging the status quo, because all those new collaborative models will, in some sense, challenge, disrupt, or threaten established ways of doing things, which are more hierarchical, less collaborative, more entrenched, so on and so forth. And so as a result, the world becomes more uncertain, because small things can have big impacts, because new players can suddenly disrupt existing markets, so on and so forth. And so again, this means that innovation, the capacity to act in the face of uncertainty, becomes really, really critical. So in a way, making sense of what I've been, some of what I've been trying to do over the last 5 years, is I've been looking at people who, when faced with this combination of things, do not stick their heads in the ground and don't sort of embed themselves in the past, but come up with practical, really effective kinds of solutions. And I'll just introduce you to a little snapshot of some of the people I'm talking about. So this is what they do. They meet constraints by creating these collaborative solutions, often by not inventing things, but by borrowing and reusing things, and challenging established models. And often in their stories, one of the things that's interesting is how humble they are. They don't want to be heroic inventors. They want to be non-heroic borrowers. And secondly, how often at the outset of their journey they were told by professionals and people who knew, you simply cannot do that, or you simply cannot do that and you shouldn't do it because it's wrong. So let me introduce a few of these people. This is literally the most creative, radical, revolutionary man that I've ever met. And this picture was taken in his kitchen in Pune in India, then the fastest growing city in Asia. And his name is Madhav Chavan, and he's the founder of Pratam, now arguably the largest and most influential educational NGO in India. And what Madhav did was take an idea that had emerged from the Mumbai University's School of Social Work to create low-cost preschool playgroups. And Madhav is not an educationalist. His background was in trade union organizing, and he brought to that challenge the sensibility of a trade union organizer. He thought, the challenge here is to grow a movement, it's not to just provide a service, and I've got no resources. How do I do it? And so what he came up with was a way to create low-cost preschool, they're called Balwadis, by training very quickly in a kind of pretty rough and ready way young women who'd graduated from school, who themselves had limited opportunities to work, needed to work close to home for all sorts of reasons, but with this kind of training and a little bit of help, could create a small micro business out of their front room by educating a handful, maybe 10, 15 children. The price point for Pratam, and I've grown to really respect people who have price points which are really low, the price point is $10 a year. So how do you educate a child for $10 a year? That's a really testing constraint. And you can only do that if you think in completely new ways. So what Madhav and his team did was develop a resource that was underutilized and crying out for opportunity, using piggybacking on existing facilities, using a lot of community input as well. Pratam has educated 21 million young people. It's 500,000 Balwadis all across India. It's so simple, it spreads like a kind of, like a virus. And when I met him literally in this, so this discussion that I was having with him in his kitchen, I met him at like 10 o'clock at night. He was coming out of his last meeting of the day with his team. They'd been discussing how to improve the maths curriculum in these preschool Balwadis. We drove across town. At about 12:30, his wife called and basically told him to get rid of me. And he said, yes, yes, yes. And then we carried on talking for another hour and a half. And he said, early on in their process, they had been introduced to McKinsey. And McKinsey had done this pro bono work and said, what you need to do is turn this into McDonald's, have a franchise, a kit, the same everywhere. And Madhav said, well, why don't we do it like a Chinese restaurant? You never go into a Chinese restaurant and think, crikey, this is a Chinese restaurant. I never realized. In other words, Chinese restaurants are absolutely obvious wherever they go, but there are no big global brands. So it's a global phenomenon, but there are no big global brands. That's because they follow the same principles, but apply those principles in different ways in different settings. So one of the lessons of Pratam, which is really interesting, is that this is not just small, this is scale. And it's scale because they adopted a very different kind of model. This is the second thing that comes from India, created by a guy called Ganesh Panadi, who was an electricity engineer in Kentucky, went back to India, spent about a year, I think, trying to think his way through how to create electricity that was affordable and clean for rural villages in the rice-growing belt of India, thought a lot about solar power, and played with various things. None of them worked. And then, after about a year, came up with going back to an old technology, biomass gasification. This is a kind of technology that was used here in World War II when we didn't have enough petrol and oil. So this is not new, this is old, and it's just reinvented. But what he did was create a way to do this at sufficient scale so that whole villages could sign up to it. So this is husk power systems, and this is classic frugal innovation in a way. It's an old technology reused and updated. It's a social solution because all of the village has to sign up to make it kind of a business model. But people can sign up very simply to very simple models. So if two houses want to share one light bulb in the alley between them so they can do things at night like homework and what have you, they can do that. You can go up to powering a fridge and a fan. But this is really basic because when the lights go out in these villages, everything stops. You can't do homework, you can't work, you can't shop, you can't see the doctor, so on and so forth. It's incredibly basic. The raw material is discarded rice husks, which had no apparent value. And finally, these two guys, these are my favourite social entrepreneurs in the world, probably, because they don't look like social entrepreneurs, they look like wide boys. And they are wide boys. And they're very kind of entertaining and engaging wide boys. And they came out of, again, one of the lessons of these people is that they often come not straight on, but they come slightly left field, or they come slightly sideways at an issue. They started some of the first and rather probably unsavory 0800 telephone numbers in Mexico. And they were casting around for other things that people would pay to listen to or down a telephone. And they thought, what about a doctor? So they employed a doctor to sit on the end of a telephone, thinking that people would call for doctorly advice. They had about three goes at it. They were on the verge of failing when the sort of mobile revolution took off. And then they worked out how to do it with basically applying a sort of call center technology to medical advice. This is without any knowledge of NHS Direct or anything like that. And they created this thing in this call center on the edge of Mexico City, which is basically a low-cost primary healthcare system. So primary healthcare in Mexico, as in much of the world, very difficult to access. To wait in the queue means taking a day off work, so you lose earnings. Then you have to wait for a long time. If you're lucky enough to get a prescription, that's another day to get the prescription, which will cost a lot. This costs $5 a month added to your phone bill. You get 24/7 medical advice, but more importantly, they've organised their callers into a kind of buying community, collaborative consumption, so you get sort of discounts of anything between 30 and 60%. And so medical home is basically, if you find it hard to create a primary healthcare system, actually piggybacking on mobile networks and using them in the right way could give you that. So these are people who have all, it seems to me, embodied this ability to think, here are binding constraints, really tough and difficult, here are rising aspirations, but if we can create new collaborative models which mobilise resources in new ways, then we can innovate, but that will mean challenging the status quo or thinking outside conventional channels. So what are the four key things that I think they do? Well, the first is they are lean. They waste nothing. Everything is reused. And they learn from Toyota, of course, the home of lean production, itself in a way of frugal innovation. Toyota on the verge of bankruptcy, unable to afford a traditional model of mass manufacturing, invents this very low-cost form of manufacturing just in time, moving around flexible machines, just-in-time delivery of parts, no wastage, because they were absolutely constrained. But that has then been taken up in all sorts of different ways, this sense that systems need to eliminate all forms of waste, be pulled by demand. The most impressive is Narayana Hospitals in India, where Dev Shetty, this guy, has created a way to do heart operations, now very famous, at a fraction of the cost of operations in the US and the UK, at much higher numbers and at higher quality. The most radical health innovations in the world are going to come from India. They already are. They're not going to come from here. We will get all sorts of interesting high-tech solutions, but the most radical mass solutions will come from India. The second thing they do is that they're simple. And they're simple because they reduce and hide features, which is a traditional designer's device, but they also create very simple systems so that it's the fact that they add up together and you don't need five different products to do it that make them effective. So my favourite example is this, Echale de Casa, which is a Mexican thing, which is basically like a cappuccino or like an espresso machine. You know, when you put the coffee in and you pull a lever and it goes like that. They do that with bricks. So you've got a community that wants to build some houses. You shovel in some dirt, put a little bit of concrete in, not very much. It goes down. You press a lever, pull a lever. This thing comes down. It compresses the earth. And out the other end pop a load of bricks like this, which you can build houses with. It's like you can start using this thing in less than 5 minutes. Two of them for 3 days will create enough bricks with virtually no other resources than kind of labour power to build 15 houses or something like that. But the beauty of it is that what they found was two other things. The first that they found was there's no point in creating a lot of bricks unless people have thought about what houses they want to build. So you need a system of planning and a system of saving. So simultaneously, they had to become about architecture and design that made sense and saving. And then they found that the big benefit was that it was highly convivial. So everyone would come together, the community would gather, and it would have all sorts of social benefits. And indeed, people would come from other villages to help this local village build its bricks and houses, which then look a lot like this. So I think these kinds of places are going to be amongst the fastest growing in the world. My prediction would be that Tata, which introduced the Nano car in India, is going to do something like this in housing in India, building low-cost, high-quality homes. So that social component is really important. They tend to be social solutions because sharing lowers costs, sharing speeds learning, and reuses scarce resources, but also this convivial nature, what Ivan Illich called convivial technology, the fact that it's socialized creates wider and lasting benefits for communities. So one of the most famous examples is the growth of M-Pesa out of a purely informal social system for using airtime as a currency, creates this banking system based on mobile networks in Kenya, which has now been copied and emulated, not in enough places in the world, but in many other places in Africa and Asia. And it's essentially a highly social system. They've created elements of a banking system without banks by using the mobile network and traditional ways, what were informal social ways for people to collaborate. And finally, they're clean. And they're clean because they have to, because that's lean. They're clean because it's social and simple. And they're clean because they believe in it. But they're clean mainly because they think of innovation as a reprocess. Why invent something when you can reuse it? Why create your own if there's something else already available? Why waste some resources when they could become an input for another system? So famously, General Electric in India have a low-cost electrocardiogram which uses a printer used on Indian buses to print tickets. Why invent a printer when you can just adapt it? And the most elegant example of this principle, that we should borrow from natural systems and think of waste as fuel, and think, as Sophie said, in much more circular ways, is actually probably someone who's been recognised by the RSA is Charlie Patton, an English inventor who created this amazing tent that uses cold sea air and solar power to condense water, fresh water out of the air, to grow vegetables. And the farm that has used this most successfully is Earthbound, is this Sundrop farm in southern Australia. And this is an entirely circular system for growing food. And food is basically an energy and water business. It's large amounts of energy and water applied to seeds. And we consume massive amounts of water, particularly, as well as energy in growing food. This creates an elegant, simple, low-cost, circular system of using seawater to be pumped, sort of pumped up, and then through those fans, which are powered by solar, to use the cool air to then cool and humidify the air inside the greenhouse, then to grow the food. We'll need more of these things, which sound wacky and weird. I remember when I first met Charlie Patton, I literally thought he was mad. It was about 15 years ago. And he described this greenhouse. He actually described it as a tent that he wanted to create. Actually, these are the people who will tell us the future. So lean, simple, social and clean. So where will they? Who will make this happen? All sorts of people need to come together. They can come from all sorts of sources. There are designers in the Western world. There are foundations that are playing a role. There are grassroots entrepreneurs. I mean, it's being fed from many, many different sources. But at its core, I think the people I met who are doing this are rooted cosmopolitans, by which I mean they have access to wider sources of knowledge and ideas and capital, but they're in a very particular place, and it's a place that they really belong to and identify with. And this sense of they are not grassroots entrepreneurs, they're not just in that place, they can connect to wider flows of ideas. And time again, when I asked them where they got their ideas from, it was mixing these two things up. So I think rooted cosmopolitans, people who can embody worlds where they have access to collaboration, have high aspirations and ambitions, but they recognise severe constraints, very important. Where will it happen? Again, it will happen in many different places. There's certainly a role for designers and design studios, for multinational labs, for research labs in universities, but by and large, I think they come, you'll find them in margins and extremes. You'll find them in difficult places to work in. And they will use their marginality and their extremity to their advantage to create these new low-cost models. And they will come from the most cosmopolitan cities in the developing world. So I think the most creative places over the next 10 to 20 years, Silicon Valley will be, I'm sure, Cambridge will be, Shoreditch will be, centres of knowledge will be, but many of the most exciting and innovative places will be cosmopolitan cities in the developing world, which have these flows of knowledge and people going through them. So Curitiba, Bogota, Rio, Nairobi, Pune, so on and so forth. These will be some of the most exciting places. And how will they do it? Well, they'll do it in the real world with real consumers. They have no option. And they'll be very adept at learning. They won't do it in artificial conditions which give them too many resources, because actually the lessons you learn there aren't readily applicable in the real world. And I think they build kinds of organisations, and I'll finish here, which are really quite different, and they scale in a different way, and they're radicants. Radicants are plants like strawberries. So a strawberry does not grow from a central root. A strawberry grows by putting down roots as it grows and drawing on local resources. So they're more like radicants. They're more like strawberries. They grow in this way that puts down roots and then draws resources from where they're growing to sustain themselves, because they don't have a big, strong central core. That can be a weakness, but it can also be a strength. and they adopt those kinds of models. So I think this is a big part of our future, that we're going to need forms of innovation which are frugal, which use fewer resources to create better outcomes for more people. They'll often employ digital technology, not necessarily at their core, but use it. And they'll be designed for a world of severe and tightening constraints, rising aspirations, and limitless possibilities of collaboration. And it's the people who can triangulate that who will be, I think, the most important innovators of the decades to come. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles. That was absolutely fascinating. And I highly recommend the book for all of you to read, because it is a brilliant insight into lots of different case studies around innovation. I think I just want to briefly touch upon some of the ideas that are happening in the RSA at the moment around the power to create, which is our new kind of strategy and aim. Because I think I was specifically taken by the end of the book, for those who have read it or are about to read it, there's a whole section at the end which is about the kind of 10 rules of thumb for people who want to go into these, or that create the perfect conditions for the innovators.
You have to remind yourself what they are. Yeah, go on, carry on.
I think that these were, the concluding part of the book about how you create the right conditions for these innovations to happen. And I think we were seeing a lot of this, and I think these to me define the right conditions for the power to create. So it's not just about being creative, but actually having those restraints around you, making sure that you are very lean with your resources, making sure that you are focused on the right insights and opportunities, and having your eyes open to often things that are closed to other people. We were talking a bit about that before. So I wondered whether we could just have a sort of quick discussion around the kind of relevance of all of this to the UK and the Western world. And we were talking a bit about, you know, how the developed world organisations and how big businesses could take this on without sort of killing the innovation and ambition of this, but actually looking towards mainstreaming these ideas so that we can build upon them.
Well, I think, I suppose there are two obvious applications, perhaps one more obvious and talked about than the other, but one is for those companies to see the developing world and these consumers in the developing world as their market, and having to understand how to create products which make sense in that world. And you can't do that unless you really attend to what their lives are like and really bother to kind of find out, rather than sort of passing off sort of slightly simplified versions of what we've got. So all the companies, and there are companies, sort of developed world companies, who are doing that, but they have really bothered to think about how they're designed. They're not just sort of, oh, we'll cut the price and give them. They really are engaging. And I think it's a really important part of that story. So companies like Unilever, General Electric and others, who I think are making real efforts to do that, are an important part of that story. But then the second bit is, what's the relevance here? So I've spent the last 2 months talking to Londoners living on anything between £22,000 and £33,000. It's incredibly difficult to live in London on that kind of income. And so actually what we need here are new models of shared consumption, new waste and energy systems. We need forms of housing that can be built simply and cheaply but cost very little to run, so on and so forth. So actually a lot of these frugal lessons we should be applying here. And there's lots in our past that's frugal that we probably need to reuse. Mm. And bring back. And so rather old-fashioned in kind of social innovations, like public space and parks, are very important.
And actually, there's another section in your book which you talk about in the 1600s, the market gardens coming up in London, which is a fantastic story about where the dung yard came from, and the kind of how there was a sort of transfer of resource from the dung coming from one end and then going back, the ships going back with loads of vegetables. And then how that then ramps up into something that is a much bigger model.
Yeah, and if you take that old idea that London was at some point its own market garden, and you take Havana, which out of necessity grows most of its own vegetables, and you take the whole thing about food, obesity, public space and so on and so forth. Actually, urban farming, which many people would dismiss as being pie in the sky, you add into the cost of transport and all the rest of it, then becomes something that you could imagine isn't just done in Todmorden, and so on and so forth. It's actually a real thing that you could imagine making work.
We saw a good example of that actually at the we were at Barcelona for the big Fab Lab, International Fab Lab conference last week, and we were working with a group of people who had got loads of old waste washing machines and were taking them apart to make new urban water systems for rooftop gardens. And it was a brilliant, because you had designers there, but also kind of local communities working together on a very low-tech, very innovative, kind of lean piece of design. In terms of the sort of scaling, and we were beginning to sort of touch upon that earlier as well, like how do you... Because something about all this is the kind of they work because they're quite local scale. And do you think that there is something about scaling up which will help society?
Well, there might be things that you need to scale in a traditional way. And when we think about scale and economies of scale, you tend to think about large organisations making a lot of the same thing, and then the average price going down and so on and so forth. Actually, I think what these guys do often more is not scale things but spread things. Mm. And spread is both about push and pull, and it is that Chinese restaurant model more, which is about using the same principles but in different settings in different ways. And often through very lateral peer-to-peer influences, so on and so forth. And so one of my favourite stories in the book is the spread of this low-cost irrigation system using plastic used in ice lollies in India called the Pepsi, which was just adapted. It's actually much more efficient than traditional forms, and it spread through a series of sort of local adaptations, and it just, no one quite knows where the idea came from or how it spread, but it did because it made sense. Mm. So I think there's that kind of model as well, and certainly the people that I met, like Madhav, who are absolutely about scale, they're on a scale way beyond what we think about. They are really ambitious. They would say you have to keep it simple, it has to really deliver very quickly, you have to be able to use local resources, it has to make sense locally, but you have to create a bit of a framework for people to work in, and then you have to kind of, you know, think like a movement.
Mm. I think the point about actually what is transferable is often the system design or the system setup. So when you were talking about the bricks, it's actually about all the other systems that fit within that. So you have the kind of the social system, and then you have the financing system, and all of those things come together. And we've really noticed that in the work that we do in the Great Recovery, that actually it's not just about redesigning a product.
Yeah.
You actually have to think about the system that goes around it. So where the value, finding out who's got the value at what point, who's going to get that value back into the system.
Yeah. So that's a point, incredibly well made by Paul Polak and others, which is, systems are much more powerful than products or services. So that machine, that brick machine, is an amazing, frugal machine, but actually it's the system that's really effective. And the system is about planning, community mobilisation, saving, and then work and community kind of commitment to it and so on and so forth. And you could churn out lots of bricks very, very cheaply, and they'd be completely wasted if you didn't have all those other things. And one of the things, when I talked to those guys, one of the things that stood out for them was that they, even though they knew the market pretty well, was you had to really understand why people wanted to build a house or build an extra room. And some people it was to increase income, some people to accommodate a larger family, to look after elderly parents, and virtually always the key decision maker was a woman. So virtually always, unless you got to the women, unless you understood what was driving them, you wouldn't really connect. You could talk to the men about the building and stuff like that, but unless you talk to the women, there'd be no point. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
And it's that sort of specificity of knowledge that really, really matters, I think.
It's a bit like the Grameen Bank model, where you actually you do microfinance to the female.
But what you mustn't do is just think this is a kind of demographic with an income like this and so on and so forth, and they need a cheaper version of that, so we'll throw them a sachet, because that doesn't understand their lives. Mm-hmm. You really do need to kind of engage.
So the last point before we throw the questions out into the audience was really about the recycling. So something obviously close to my heart, because I spend quite a lot of time on recycling and landfill dumps for my sins in the work. So I'm quite interested in the kind of model in Curitiba, where you have your innovative collectors on the street. And we were talking about the difference between that and Rio. So, you know, where you have a very efficient picker system, but it's very informal. So it's a very frugal innovators. And actually, you know, you have a number of people who live literally on the very large landfill, and they take out what they can. And they have a system where somebody comes and said, look, we need loads of plastic bottles today, and then we've got a high price, so find me as many as you can. But their kind of system that supports them isn't there. And how then can we, you know, again, it goes back to formalising a system where you want to keep that kind of success of the people that are working there and their knowledge and expertise that they have in terms of understanding the different materials that are going through the system. But they don't have any schools, or their favelas are very bad, or they kind of don't have a sort of formalised system. Have you seen, good examples of that? Do you see that in Curitiba?
Well, I think Curitiba is the best place to go, I think, that I've been, certainly, to understand how a public authority is engaging with a sort of bottom-up process of innovation or enabling it. It's a very tricky thing to do, but I think that is one of the biggest opportunities, is that sort of Tata space, which is, if people currently live in mud huts with tin roofs, how do you give them easy to construct better houses which fit within slums? Don't take them out, but fit within where they are. Because the thing about going to a lot of those places is, when you walk around, it's kind of like they're almost there.
Yeah.
And they've got quite a lot of solutions. There are no cars. They're very local. They're very dense. They're incredibly social. There are bits to them that really, really work. There's an enormous amount of make-do collaborative innovation. And yet, in other respects, there can be disaster zones. So you don't want to sort of flatten them. That would be completely the wrong thing to do. Mm. But you can have frugal and deeply suboptimal solutions, which are second best solutions, which are pickers living on landfill sites. So that, I think, is a really interesting space, I think.
That's a space, actually, which we could learn a lot here, you know, how that kind of bottom-up understanding of public authority and kind of local governance, and how we learn and sort of enable and support and encourage that kind of innovation to happen.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm going to... I open it up to the audience now. And we'll start with the lady in the purple dress.
Thank you. My name's Leona Strellard. So my question is, without dismissing the tremendous significance of all of this for the demographic context which you've been describing, but if we're trying to extract lessons for applications for this economy...
Here,
how do you deal with this knotty three letters of ROI, you know, when you cite the example of cardiac surgery, when our health system could be so much more productive if the marginal expectations of returns weren't so high? So how do you deal with that? And I also, can you cite any example where the innovation is coming at the supply chain end rather than at the consumer end, as in market gardening, for example? I think it would be useful to put some emphasis on how the supply chain might innovate with more frugal expectations and more productively, rather than the emphasis on adaptations on the consumer side, which are necessarily small.
This question comes from Yogesh Taylor via Twitter. Question is, how do we fund frugal innovation when one of its main facets is the lack of money involved?
Nico McDonald, a fellow. I'm interested in how this fits with larger scale models of innovation. I think most of the improvement in the quality of life, if not more of the social side of life that we've seen in the last two decades, has been in China, where the models of innovation are very different from the ones that you've outlined. And whether we're going back to Schumacher's Small is Beautiful and the appropriate technology movement of the 70s, which had many limitations and which haven't delivered on their ambitions, what's actually new about what you're talking about? And is there a danger of, you've said we need to apply these models in the developed world, is there a danger actually the outcome of your philosophy will really be to rationalize low levels of innovation and improvement in the developed world rather than the mass scale of improving the quality of life we need in the developing world?
That's a good three to start.
As far as ROI goes, these are often, they don't require much investment. They often require the reorganization of what's currently there. But they often require you to look at sort of total costs in the system or life cycle costs rather than just specific unit costs as well. And so it depends where you're counting the cost in these things often. And I think that our public sector now too often counts the costs of specific activities and doesn't look at whole life cycle costs. Because if you look at whole life cycle costs, you tilt it much more towards preventative solutions, which can have additive benefits and so on and so forth. So that's part of that. But I think one of the biggest challenges, like medical home, they've had people come and visit them from all over the world and by and large say, we'd love to have this, but we can't because actually we've got entrenched systems which just wouldn't allow it or so on and so forth. So, and you're right on the supply side thing. So one of the most interesting things is going to be, I think, if large companies can engage with this through things like hybrid value chains and other things to agglomerate smaller producers. And some of them, like Toyota's original lean thing, is a process innovation. I mean, it's a really, really important process innovation with very, very important principles in it. So we shouldn't just think of the consumer end. You're absolutely right. How should we fund it, given they're frugal? That's a really good question. But I suspect one of the things is not to create large, frugal innovation funds. I had dinner once with George Soros, and I said, so how do you do it? How do you fund stuff all around the world? And he said, basically, what we do is we go to a place like Burma, and we give people lots of money, and we let lots of things happen, and nothing actually very much happens. And then you take the money away, and when you take the money away, you find out who's really serious, because then it's the people who carry on who are really, really serious. And that is one of the dilemmas of all funders, is that sort of funding becomes a sort of teat, and actually it's the people who carry on when there isn't money, because there's a business model or other things. So that I think, is part of it. But each of many of the things that I have looked at have had far-sighted foundations at a very early stage, doing important things to get them going. But by and large, they have then bootstrapped themselves. So it's not a venture capital model. It's a sort of bootstrapping business, kind of revenue-generating business model. So bootstrap, I think, rather than venture capital. Nor is it a kind of sell-out to Google model like that. And then Nico's questions, there are two. I took from your comments, Nico, two questions. One isn't scale of innovation better because isn't China a counterexample? Well, in some ways, but there are all sorts of versions of this in China, of people doing things in frugal ways. both in commercial and non-commercial settings, they have their own version of a kind of lean, simple, adapted, borrowed kind of stuff going on. So it's not, I don't think you should read China just through a sort of language of scale, infrastructure, stuff like that. There's a mass of this kind of stuff going on, both in the commercial sector and not. So if you look at the growth of the Chinese motorcycle industry and how it's displaced Japan as the leading producer, much of it is to do with collaborative, simple, lean solutions that they've developed. And they have found in some of those sectors ways of getting small to be big. That's the challenge. So you're right to say, well, you know, isn't this all sort of going back to small? We need scale solutions. You know, people like Madhab are thinking at much bigger scale than people in the UK, and they need to. And there is a danger, I suppose, that we might rationalise, say, oh, let's accept second best. But the only counterpoint that I'd make to that is that I think quite a lot of the time we misunderstand innovation. We think it's going to come from Google and new tech and stuff like that. And actually, many of the most important innovations can be organizational, process, and they can be about really basic things. And the one thing that I came away from this thinking very strongly is that the thing we need most innovation about is not the transition from 3G to 4G, or the latest apps, it's water. Yeah, it is the most basic thing. And actually, innovating around water is the biggest challenge I think we face.
Yeah, and I would say actually that some of the examples that we've found around supply chain innovation in this way is about, that's kind of been pushed by a lot of restraints, so price volatility of resource and water issues. And we are beginning to see it in some of the big companies. They are innovating, or they're allowing their supply chain to innovate and supporting them, particularly in the small producers. If you look at the examples of the sustainable living plan that Unilever are doing, for instance, you know, they've actually allowing that to happen. We do have time for another set of questions.
Nick Corston from Steamco. We've got Tristan Hunt in on Thursday and a brand new education secretary in Nicky Morgan. So I just wondered what advice you might have for the education system and how we might encourage a spirit and a culture of creativity for this frugal future that we all face.
Anoop Maney, social reformer in healthcare. I was interested in the issues around spread versus franchise, and it sounds like a very attractive model if you don't have to be laboured with franchise costs. But just your experience and thoughts around how you maintain quality in systems that rely on spread or copycat versus franchise, which is clearly the benefit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good question.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And so that is the key question. And so Vicky Colbert set up this thing, Escuela Nueva, in Colombia, which is a way to allow children to learn together in groups. So one teacher can teach 60 children in rural schools, born out of complete necessity as a sort of frugal model. And she sort of gave it away before anyone had talked about Creative Commons and open source. It's been copied all over the world. And she's got no purchase on quality whatsoever. And particularly then when it became a government program, actually all sorts of people started calling themselves new schools, Escuela Nueva. And actually she had no, you know, they would take all sorts of bits out of the model and she had no control over it. So I think that is, you're absolutely right, the real challenge. What they've done at Pratam is that basically Madhav just said, what happened with Madhav was that his original funders said, if you can do 1,000 of these in 6 months, we'll give you some more money. And so he got 3,000 of them. I love that. That's so impressive. Like, you know, people, I'm so involved in so many projects that go from 5 to 12, and it's like huge, you know, to go from 1,000 to 3,000. And his philosophy was, let's just fill in the quality later. And that's what they've been successively doing. There is a very interesting thing going on in education, which I'll come into at the moment, with Code Club and Apps for Good and things like that. But we could, in this country, create a entirely complementary, voluntary-based
coding education system entirely based around clubs and volunteers, but the issue will be quality. So you're absolutely right to talk about that. And then on education, I'm writing something about this at the moment, and this stupid things, but I mean, education should be an education in how to live in this kind of world. And so it should be an education in how you work within constraints, to find questions that you don't know the answer to, and there will be many more than one answer to, in collaboration with other people, and how you learn to make things together. And you produce things, and you do it in the real world as much as the classroom. And that's what education should be. And it, should, of course, should also be about learning English and maths and doing it through geography and history and so on and so forth. Of course it should be that, and you need sort of some element of structure and so on and so forth. But actually we need to educate entire generations of people to go and look for problems and opportunities and collaborate to solve them. That's what it should be core about, I think. And the trouble is that we don't have any political leadership which is willing to speak that truth, because they want to speak a language of safety, caution, and a sort of education as a sort of 16-year apprenticeship in diligently coming up with the right answer at the right time. How is that going to help? How is that going to help them in this world? There's no right answer. There are new problems the whole time. You have to find new collaborators. You have to think in fresh ways. You have to make and fail and try again. That's that world. That's the world they're already in. And yet we create an education system which is like sort of, you know, if you judge the education system by whether it did any harm, then we'd be really failing, it seems to me. So, you know, it really, really, really frustrates me.
Wow. On that note, Sally, we've run out of time. So thanks again for the fantastic set of questions, and a reminder that the book is on sale outside, and I'm sure you're going to be there to sign. I would highly recommend it. There's some brilliant case studies in there, and as I said, the 10 rules at the back are fantastic sort of steps for us to move towards something which is about frugal innovation. And finally, do join me in thanking Charlie Ledbetter for your time.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.